Success stories and interviews with game changers and thought leaders who have overcome both in life and in business. Welcome to Vertical Momentum.
Hey guys, welcome to
welcome
to another episode of Vertical Momentum, guys. This is going to be a great episode with my new friend. He has an amazing book and amazing story, but first I want to thank our sponsors. As you guys know, if you were ever in the military, even for a day, you drank some shitty coffee. And we have a new company that just came out. It's called Soldier Girl Coffee. Female veteran-owned company. Amazing coffee. And now they even have it infused with CBD. So definitely check out Soldier Girl Coffee if you want good-tasting coffee. But guys, this the gentleman that we're going to about to talk to has an amazing book, Echo and Ramadi. He's got an amazing story. He's changing people's lives and businesses as we speak. So please welcome our friend Scott to the show. My brother, what's going on?
Hey, how are you, Richard? You're in. Good?
Oh, you sound perfect, brother.
Great.
You sound amazing. So how's your day going so far?
Good. I'm actually with you from Bastard.
You cut out on me, brother. Your phone probably went to lock. So you can't, you're muted.
So.
Cool.
Today, yeah.
That's awesome. So talk to us about, you're a well-known speaker. You've been featured everywhere. Your book has become a bestseller, but it's more about the people that are in the book than the actual book itself, correct?
It is. And I think that I've been very, very fortunate that the book has become this evergreen where I get readers from not just the military. And I think that that's probably one of the most rewarding things when you kind of barf your life into 300 pages and hang it out there for everybody to read is that it affects more than just those who served and those I wrote about in Echo and Ramadi, because there's so many people across the country and around the world that have sent me emails or messages thanking me for sharing not only this about the service and sacrifice of these young men and women who fought in Iraq's deadliest city in 2006 and 2007, but it's really is a story about people and leadership and team building, overcoming adversity, all these things that really bring us together, that brought you and I together, this power of human connection that is so overwhelming at times. It continues to humble me. And I'm very, very fortunate to meet so many people like you who really get out there and continue to share this story. Because we were talking before the show about how you love to tell stories. And as a guy who writes and is a storyteller, it's really important, I think, to the listeners, to the show. It's cool because I have that philosophy is, every book is brand new to someone that's never heard of it. And that's really been something great that's come out of this journey that started 3 years ago, man. It's hard to believe. And, I can talk about the book all day, but I also love talking about what I'm doing now and what our nonprofit is doing now. And, the book's what I did. Serving in the Marine Corps for 24 years is what I did. And I think that really what defines people is what you're doing now to continue that momentum forward.
I love that. But first, I like to hop in the Wayback Machine. So where are you originally from and what kind of little boy were you?
Bad, in a word. I was born in Waukegan, Illinois, far north suburb of Chicago. And my mom, amazing woman, raised me and after my parents divorced. And so, I didn't have a whole lot of adult supervision growing up. And then moved back to live with my dad in high school. And again, it was a bit of a wayward kid. I drank underage. I rode a motorcycle, was my first car. I got in fights. I got chased by the cops. I got caught by the cops. So I barely squeaked out of high school with a stellar 1.24 GPA. I challenge any listeners, if they can chime in and send you a message, that if they could beat that. I doubt it. I think that record stands, but I did much better in college ultimately. But at the time I was not college material. And
were you an athlete at all?
Yeah, I played football and I swam and but I hung with a rough crowd and just didn't put a lot of rigor into school. It really didn't take with me. And it wasn't until I got a phone call from a good friend of mine, and he calls me up. He says, "Man, you'll never guess what I did today, Scotty." So what now? What did you do? Buy another new car? And he says, "I joined the Marines." And he ropes me in, has me come down and meet these recruiters. And that's a 18-year-old kid who'd led a pretty high risk lifestyle up to that point. When I met these recruiters, as you know, because you're in the Army, that they talk a great game. And you walk into the office and there's camouflage netting over, and they're wearing these uniforms with all their medals, and they talk a good game. And I thought to myself, man, there is no bigger group of risk takers than these Marines. And I signed up and I enlisted. I went to Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and then ultimately found the error of my ways and hung up my rifle for a little bit. And I joined the reserves as a machine gunner and went to college, and I graduated in 3 years. What is important about this story is not my speedy career in college, but I say that because I really think it's a testament to what the military instills in young men and women, is that discipline and how to treat things like a mission. And that's what I did. I went to high school, day school, preschool, and I was in and out in 3 years. And I think I wound up with like a 3.0 GPA, and I worked full time as well. So
now, one thing I love about Marines is, number one, I love all my Marines. Number one is, I think you have the nicest looking uniforms ever, bottom line. Second of all, I love the mindset that once a Marine, always a Marine. I love that mindset, that never quit kind of mindset. So what was it like coming from being a wild child to then going to basic and having to go through that? What was it, something you quickly adapted to?
I did. I think that a lot of people who come from upbringing such as mine really are seeking something out. And I don't have a PhD hanging on my wall, and I didn't do a thesis on this, but I think it's an interesting study of the high numbers of those who come from some sort of broken homes. When they get introduced to that military environment, I think you're really, one, you're kind of a seeker. You're looking for challenges in life. And two, it really gives you a sense of purpose. And you may not have been taught this growing up from the age of birth to age 18 or whatever age you joined the military, but we who join the military and serve in law enforcement, we're this group of protectors. And I think that that's something that is just imbued in us throughout our upbringing, is we become protectors in some sense. And there's a call to serve. It's not just hyperbole. I think that really is a calling. So when I was at boot camp, even on the way to boot camp, I was the guy in charge of holding everyone's records in the box. And then I was the platoon leader, the guy. I graduated the top of my class, and then went to the operating forces and continued to succeed. But at one point I realized that, and this was probably through seeing some poor leadership, that I understood the value of an education. And that's when I decided to go, get off active duty, join the reserves, and go to college and really apply myself, because I think that's what great leaders do, is they continue to challenge themselves. And that ultimately worked out to my advantage, I think, because I gained a lot of perspective. But college taught me one thing. It didn't teach me how to apply my degree. It really taught me how to teach myself. And I've continued to do that throughout my life and become a better learner, become a better reader. And one of the most important things is becoming a better listener.
And, and I love that, because, even in relationships, if you're married, guys, girls out there, listen, there's a difference between hearing and listening. There's a big difference. And a lot of people don't realize that until they're divorced. And it was a reason why, because they didn't have any communication skills, because they did not listen. They just heard everything. You know what I mean?
Oh, I'm sure you can appreciate that more, having your vision limited, to how that makes you a better listener. I mean, it's fascinating when I hear how people tune in on that. I mean, did you before you were involved in that tragedy, do you think you were a good listener at that point, or did it take you losing part of your vision to really understand that?
I think it took me to lose my vision to start actually amplifying my hearing. And because, like, a lot of times if you watch a movie, you're going to miss so much stuff. Mm. Where a lot of times if you listen to the movie, you'll get more out of it than actually watching it. Mm. So that was something I had to learn the hard way. But it's benefited me in doing the podcasting and interviewing, because now I get to hang on each person's words and actually listen to what they're saying, instead of me thinking, well, what's the next question I'm going to ask? Mm. You know?
I think it's a absolute learned skill to be a great listener. Some people, I believe, have it more naturally than others, but those who are able to stand in the fringes of conversations and listen, I pick up on that now, and I see these people, I'm like, God, I wish I could be like that person more, because I know it's a bit ironic from a guy that travels around the country and does a bunch of national public speaking, but it's listening after I give a keynote or an address or a discussion to someone, that I get to meet so many interesting people who are way, way, way outside the military circles that I traditionally ran with for the better part of my adult life. And I'm continually learning stuff, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, that's one thing I love having about my, you know, having my own show, because here I am, I have a ninth grade dropout. And I get to talk to gentlemen like you, gentlemen like General Petraeus, Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I'm like, wow, I'm truly humbled that God has given me this platform. So I got to ask you, because you went from an enlisted man to the officer side. So tell us what that mindset shift was like.
Well, it wasn't a tough transition for me. And I get asked that question a lot. I was recently at Camp Pendleton to speak to about 250 ROTC students from across the country and all these programs from different colleges. And one of the midshipmen asked me that question, because he had been enlisted before he went to college. And I answer the same way every time, is that being enlisted did not make me a better officer, but it absolutely gave me better perspective on how important that young Marine's time is, or how important that young soldier's time is. And I never wanted to waste that. So I think that's what I brought along with me when I got commissioned as an officer, and having the privilege to lead and understanding how much the military invests in its officers before they're ever given the chance to stand in front of 45 young Marines or soldiers that the parents of them entrust to that leadership, because it is an absolute honor and privilege that I never want to take for granted. And I think that being enlisted helps a lot of guys. I think there's also people out there that may be a disadvantage, because they think, oh, well, I've been there, I've done that. And sometimes the officers that come out of service academies get a bad rap because they weren't enlisted. But I've met scores and scores of some of the finest officers that never were enlisted, and they didn't need that to be great. And I think that the same can be said for a lot of the senior enlisted Marines that I served with, who have much higher degrees than I do, but they make a decision that they want to stay and be operational and do this. And that was a choice they made, and I respect both sides of that.
And I love that. Now, like the day that I got ran over, I was such a hard charger that I didn't even go home. I finished out my 2 weeks training, but they put me in, and I'm half blind, but they put me in, for the first time ever, they put me in a TOC. And it was at that at that point, I never realized how important looking at the big picture is, you know, because like I was a tank commander. So that was my job. Mm. All I thought about was my guys and my platoon. But I never looked at it at the big pictures until the sergeant majors and the generals and the majors would actually sit and plan for the whole United States. So I never really took that into consideration till the week, you know, after I got hurt, that sometimes we're so busy looking at our little thing that we got going on that we don't really look at the big picture. That's why it's pretty amazing that you were able to be on both sides so you can see both sides of the fence and make the right decisions, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me about your book, you know, because I read it twice, obviously. I love the book. And it's not just, you know, a lot of people look at the book. It's a people story. And I'm the kind of guy that I'll cry at a heartbeat. I'm a wussy like that. And I actually got choked up a couple of times because it's more of a people book than I think a war book. Correct? Is that how you
meant it? I'm sure people look at the cover of the book and they see this silhouette of a badass Marine who's going to kick in your door in the middle of the night and do bad things to you, which we are vastly and well-equipped to do. But I couldn't put a vase of tulips on the cover of the book. Wouldn't have sold any copies. But we went through the process of interviewing over 100 people, not just my Marines and the soldiers who fought alongside of us in Iraq in 2006, but the families, to really pull these stories of not just the fighting and friction, but also some of the things that were going on while we fought, and then some of the things that happened after we came home, things that happened to me, things that happened to our other Marines who have sadly committed suicide, and to share their stories, because those are the real stories that were important to me. It wasn't so much making sure that this significant historic battle didn't fall under the shadows of the Kandahars and the Baghdads and the Fallujahs, but to share the power of human connection. And that was the most important thing to me, that I didn't want to lose that when I wrote this story. So it's not a war story. It is a story about people. And that's been amplified thousands and thousands of times from the feedback you get when you share that, because I think that was the most important thing to me. And for any of the listeners that don't understand where Ramadi is or what was going on there, that was 2006, at the height of the insurgency in Iraq. The country and Al-Anbar province had turned into what I call this giant game of whack-a-mole, where well-trained insurgent groups were popping up in cities like Baghdad and Fallujah, and then we would just hammer them down, and they'd go to ground, and then they'd pop back up. And then when George W. Bush and General Petraeus ordered the surge strategy, it really allowed us that power to go in and cover down on all of these cities. And in 2006, Ramadi just happened to be where they decided to make a stand and fight. And it was some of the bloodiest fighting in modern urban warfare. And we were fighting 5, 6, 7 times a day, a couple times a day, in direct contact with a very well-trained enemy force. And we lost Marines and soldiers, and we had casualties, but we also killed a lot of bad guys. And that's what our job was at the end of the day. And it wasn't a metric of success that we killed this many people and we are winning. The metrics of success, Richard, was bringing as many guys home with me as I could alive. And that's how I defined winning, because at the administrative and strategic level, the planners, I don't think they ever defined what winning was for us in this war. And 15 years later, we still have troops in Iraq. We still have people in Afghanistan. And this has been a talking point for me on several interviews about why we invested so much treasure, capital, the finest young men and women to fight these wars, when we never clearly defined what winning was. And that isn't something a bunch of veterans sit around and cry in our beer about, woe is me, we lost brothers and sisters, and it was all for naught, because we don't talk about that. We do our job at the tactical level, and we get results that are our orders to follow. And I think that, you know, there's an aspect of the book that really addresses that, and sort of not just my frustration, but I think that it's emblematic of a lot of soldiers and professionals who fought in this war really want to understand and ask those questions. And I continue to ask that question in different forums, but it's important to me.
And, you know, some of the parts of the book that touched me, I mean, like, like I said, I have to read. If you see my Mr. Magoo glass, you'd laugh. But some of the parts that really touched me is when people that are not military, they don't realize that, you know, the husbands and wives that are home, they go through the same deployment that we're going to through. Mm-hmm. They're just home. And sometimes they have to take on a father, a mother, the financial role. And sometimes we kind of neglect to talk about the people that were left behind us. And like one of my friends, his name is Charles Strange. He lost his son. He was one of the 32 SEALs that went down in the helicopter in Afghanistan. And you don't really think about the Gold Star families and stuff like that. So that's one thing I think about your book, is it really touches on how there's a war going on at home, abroad, but there's also sometimes a lot of stuff that goes on at home that really doesn't get talked about.
It's interesting because a lot of the families that don't live, or it's kind of a double-edged sword, because a lot of the families that don't have a robust support structure that live close to military bases like San Diego or Jacksonville or Fort Benning or wherever they're at when their soldier Marine goes away. There's some people in Iowa or Nebraska, and they're left alone and afraid as their families are out fighting these wars. And at the same time, those people near those bases may have resources, but they become lost in the sea of other families that really need services. And when we talk about our Gold Star families, those moms and dads and husbands and wives that lost their loved ones in combat, you know, they'll never be able to replace that person. And, you know, as hard as it is for some people to connect with them, they have to know, if there's any Gold Stars listening, that, you know, they inherited this, you know, 250 additional sons if they lost theirs, and whether they like it or not, we're here for them. And that's part of what we try to do, is to stay connected with them. And, you know, I've been so fortunate to, you know, be involved with so many people are doing such great things. Our nonprofit, SaveTheBrave.org, is partnered with Herschel Woody Williams Foundation this month, as a matter of fact, to do a really cool auction for a rifle that Woody signed, and he's the last living Medal of Honor recipient. And BlackstoneArms.com built this rifle for us. You'd love it. It's a sexy M1 SOCOM. It's not like your grandpa's M1. And, you know, they've built 81 Gold Star family memorials across the country to date. And I was just with Woody in Texas, and he continues to inspire me at age 96 for what he's doing for our Gold Star families. And every year I get invited to come up to San Francisco at the Marines Memorial Club and, you know, spend the weekend with our Gold Star families in California. And it keeps me connected, I think. And it's something I think I have the capacity to do. I know everyone doesn't do that, but I like to think that it's part of my responsibility as a leader to stay connected to those families, because we're here for them no matter what. And it's something I'm very grateful that I do have that capacity to do, because again, not everyone has that. Not everyone has to write a book. Not everyone has to do this, but if there's veterans out there that are listening to this show, and you know, you're struggling with your purpose or your mission in life, or you're thinking about, you're on that breaking point where you're going to be pushed to that isolation point where suicide pops in your head, you have to know there's so many people out there that want to stay connected to you and really help. And, you know, SaveTheBrave.org, that's what we do. We connect veterans through outreach programs and bring our tribe together. I think it's a lifelong mission for me to do that in addition to everything else I do. And that's a job I take on willingly, Richard. And we take no money for it. I don't get paid for it like you. You're a storyteller, and we're doing it for the greater good. And at the beginning and the end of every day, I really, really believe this, is that if I'm not out there helping other people, I'm not helping myself. And that is what I do. And it doesn't do anything but fuel my tank as far as soul food goes, you know, when you're helping other people that need it.
Yeah, and I love that. And it sounds like you have an attitude of gratitude like I do. So while you were in, and then we'll hop on to what you're doing now. But while you were in, like for me, you know, I got thrown out the first time for being a drug addict. Everybody knows that. I got back in and I got, as they say, got my head out of my ass. One soldier of the year and all that good stuff. But the biggest title I ever got was when I became an NCO. And that's when I actually really lived the NCO creed, to where it was always about my guys, taking care of my guys. You know, because there's an old saying that, you know, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great part of being a leader, you know, because people could, they say, you know, you could respect the rank, but you don't have to respect the man. So talk to us about what real leadership is.
You basically stole my thunder there, but I say that a lot, is it never matters so much about how much you know, so much as it matters how much you care. And I could teach Marines a lot of things. I could teach them how to run faster, how to shoot straighter, how to be a better problem solver. But I could never teach them one thing. I could never teach them how to care. And I think if you don't wake up every morning passionate about what you do and you don't care, you got to find another job. You certainly can't lead Marines into combat. You certainly shouldn't be in the military, because it is such a people business. What we do, we're so bonded through shared adversity and our loyalty to our service branch and to our country and to our families. But if you don't care about that in your heart, it's all for naught. And that's probably one of the biggest leadership pieces of advice that I give aspiring leaders. And that's probably what I told those guys and girls last week when we were sitting out on the range at Camp Pendleton, is that you have to care, because the responsibility for those you lead is so great. And, you know, I'm not going to say I was the best listener my whole career, or the best leader my whole career, but I was very, very fortunate to be surrounded by so many great leaders and mentors that ultimately become friends. And I think that people throw that word mentorship around a lot. I don't necessarily subscribe to the definition. I think it's more of friendship and caring. And you pick up the phone and you call and you check in, and you check back on those people that you've led, because that's one of the things that is a difference in leadership styles, is I'm not just content to say, well, I served 24 years in the Marines and I was in this unit, I was in that unit, I led these guys, I continue to lead them. I think it is a commitment of lifelong leadership and staying connected to all of those people. And again, being one of those people who's, you know, I've done this.
I think your phone might have locked because you're on mute. I can't hear you, brother. So, guys, what we're talking about being a true leader. I think that I've been told that I was a good leader, and that people were willing to run through walls for me because they knew that I cared about them. So I think, you know, what we're talking about is, even in the business world, you know, there's a difference between being a boss and being a leader. And if you, And if you've ever been in the military, you know that there's great leaders that you worked with, and there's probably some crappy leaders that you went that you had. So, you know, if you guys are listening to this and you're trying to decide what kind of leader that you want to be, definitely try to start, like we were talking about earlier, you know, try to listen more and, you know, try to, you don't have to be that huggy feely kind of guy, because you probably get in trouble for that now, by the way, with everything that we're going through. But try to care a little bit more, you know, try to listen, try to, you know, do active listening. Because sometimes, like we're talking about, hearing is different than listening. So we're talking, I don't know what happened, but oh well. So we're talking about leadership. Now, you did over 24 years in the military, correct?
Yes.
So, I mean, obviously the things I talk about are not sexy and all that stuff, but when you decided to hang up the uniform for the last time, did you come out okay? Did you notice anything was off at all mentally?
I don't have any regrets. I think that everybody knows when it stops being fun, or you know, I had some service related injuries as well that I just wasn't able to keep up. And I think in fairness to the people you lead, that's the responsibility you have. So I made the decision to retire at 24 years, and I don't have any regrets, because I was either a Marine or leading Marines my entire time. And I got some really great jobs. I never had to get jammed up with recruiting duty, which is a great job, or do a Pentagon tour. I was always operational. So I don't look back and say, man, I wish I'd have done that, or man, I wish I'd done this. I think that I'm pretty happy with the choices I made throughout my career, and that they served me well, because I was exposed to a lot of great people along the way. And I still am. Because that's the really cool thing about continuing to be connected about, the military tribe is staying connected and helping other people up as you go. And what I loved about your story is one of the key components of being a great leader, and especially when you enjoy sitting where we do now, is you share the losses and the failures of what you did early on. And I think that's what really great leaders who continue to lead do. Is not talking about the wins and not talking about how great I was, or I did this, and everything is punctuated with that I, but all the things you failed at, so others don't have to repeat those same mistakes.
You know, and I love that. And, you know, like, I've been in recovery. I've been sober now. I just hit 32 years, January 1st. But, you know, in the program, it says that, you know, I get drunk, but we stay sober. So it's always been a we thing. And I believe, you know, in having your team and your tribe. But I find, you know, now that I've interviewed so many people, that, you know, when they get out, you know, not only do they lose their career, they lose their mission, and then they lose the camaraderie, and they feel all alone, and they start to isolate. So what was your transitioning like?
Well, I started working even while I was on terminal leave. So it was a easy transition for me to go into the private sector. And I wasn't one of those belt fed guys that was all oorah all the time. I always understood that there's a time to be militant and there's a time to be civil. And the Marine Corps, although it's a big, big part of what shaped me, it never really defined me as a person. I was very grateful for the experiences, but as I transitioned, it wasn't that difficult for me. And it wasn't that difficult because I also knew that I needed to stay connected to just balance myself out during that transition period. And working in the private sector for a couple of years, I just decided that I didn't have to do this one thing for another 20 years. I can do something else. And that's when I decided to shift again and lock myself in my studio in my ranch and wrote Echo and Ramadi. And that's been something that I've been really happy to do, is to share that story. But that, again, that's what I did. I did that 3 years ago. And I think it's all about what you're doing now and what you're going to do in the next 5 years that you really have to focus on to continue to be successful.
Now, when, you know, because when I wrote my first book, it was very cathartic, but it also ripped open a lot of wounds that had needed to be healed. So what was your writing process, and was it very cathartic for you?
No, I went every time I write, and I've been writing a long time, is it's math. It's a math problem you have to solve to create that story. And it all starts with the greatest story that you feel passionate about telling, and then breaking it down into three great parts: beginning, middle, and end. And then all of those elements to a great story, how the story arc evolves, and those series of progressive complications, and the wins and the losses, and that hero's journey, and how you tie that all in together is something. That's how I approach, whether it's a 1,000-word article for USA Today, or working on another book, or working on my documentary. It's always a process. So I didn't have this big catharsis where when I typed in the end, like you see in the movies, I'm like weepy and tears of joy. It wasn't like that. The real awakening or catharsis, I guess, comes each and every day when I get emails from readers that I don't even know, who are, again, may not have ever served. I got this one email, Richard, from a nurse in West Virginia. It was a few months back, and it's like this five scroller email, and I'm thinking, oh great, because it starts off with, I read your book and my daughter's dating a Marine. I was like, this, here we go, like I'm gonna get it. And she goes on to tell me about how she wanted a better understanding of what Marines do and the service and sacrifice. And she was a nurse in this emergency room in West Virginia. And I just felt really compelled to email her back, because the one thing I shared with her was my gratitude, one, for reading the book, but also the fact that she has an understanding of not just loss and trauma every single day and dealing with that and compartmentalizing that, but also being in a position where you can see healing. And I think that that's something we forget too, is this group of people that take care of others that can't take care of themselves, is we just see the pain and the trauma and the worst of humanity at times, but we don't reflect enough on all of the healing and all the greatness that comes out of it. Even war, when you're surrounded in this environment of death and destruction and the worst of humanity, we don't have time to stop and smell the roses. But I have often thought back to that, about how war is and that chaos and friction of combat is really a beautiful thing when you look back at it. Not, and I think that's not in the esoteric sense, but the landscape as it's presented to you, and the brotherhood and sisterhood that can only be forged in combat, and the things you experience. When I look back on that, that to me is a remarkably beautiful thing. And I think it's hard to put that in perspective for a lot of people, but I like sharing that message, and I like sharing other people's stories too, that reach out to me and tell me how it impacted them. Because when you lead and you write and you share, you're not doing it for selfish reasons. It's like, oh, I hope I get 1,000 emails and people love this. Or, you know, you don't seek that out. And you could go your entire life not even knowing you've made an impact. But when you get those pieces of feedback from people, Marine soldiers, civilians, that you have made a small impact, that's meaningful stuff to me.
Yeah, you know, I interviewed, when I first started doing this, I interviewed a guy, his last name was Hendrickson, and he's been on like 9 deployments. And yeah, he told me, you know, he said, I've seen the worst of people and I've seen the best of people. And you know, and he's like, and I was like, wow, that's really amazing. And he said, yeah. He's like, when I was at my worst, there were people that were at their best. So that I can totally understand, you know.
Yeah. And anybody listening, Orion Hendrickson is a good friend of mine that I met in Tennessee. Tip of the Spear.
Yep.
That's a shit hot book that people need to read too, because it's, and again, Ryan did an amazing job telling that story, because it's not just about kicking in doors and jumping out of airplanes. It's really about the losses and trauma that he endured throughout his life that made him who he is today. And he's been really successful. I'm so happy for Ryan, man. He's crushing it.
What a great person, you know, awesome individual. But now we're going to talk a little bit about business, because this is also a business podcast. You know, a lot of times I'm seeing people that are getting out of the military. They want to start a t-shirt company, hat company, coffee or liquor. 6 months later, they're $10,000 in debt and don't know what the hell just happened. And I think a lot of it is because when we're in the military, we're taught about, you know, standing SOPs, you know, we're taught about doing a nine line, but we really don't prepare when we want to go into business and do stuff like that. Mm. And one of my friends, is on Shark Tank. You know, he always says that, you know, if you don't have a business plan, you don't have a business. You just have a hobby that you're spending a lot of money on. So what are your thoughts about the military and what good things it does can teach you for business in the future?
Well, I think that you have to invest in yourself to be successful, whether you're entrepreneur, whether you're in the restaurant business, whether you're a writer in the entertainment business, you have to invest in yourself to be great. And you also have to do one thing, understand what your value is. And you would be amazed at how many people I talk to and I ask them this question: what's your hourly rate? And it's dead silent. They have no idea what their hourly rate is. No fucking clue. I said, I know what my hourly rate is. I know what I'm worth. I know what 10 deployments and being a best-selling author and all of my experiences and all the schools and everything I have, I know what my worth is. And if you can't articulate that into your business plan, you're going to continue to struggle or fail, worst off. And I think that, again, you have to be able to balance that based off of your experiences. Now, obviously, a soldier or Marine that's got 4 years and did this and doesn't have, you know, my experience. So obviously your value is going to differ. But I think it's very important, because the other problem that I've noticed in the veteran community is we lead this life of service. So we are geared to do things for free. And if you don't understand what you're worth and you continue to have that mindset, like, oh, I'm going to do all this for free, you're never going to get ahead. Because the problem is that there's also this perception from the private sector that, oh, you are a veteran, oh, you served your country, you're going to continue to give it away for free. I got news for you. No, I'm not going to give it away for free, because no one can tell my story like I can tell my story. And if you can find that person that's similar to that who wants to do it free, great. But it's not Scott Husing. And I don't say that for selfish reasons. I say that for the sake of reality, man, is that you got to pay the light bill. You have to provide for your family. You have to continue to get to that level. And it's not to pad your savings account. For me, I would rather do that and be hard on myself and be shrewd in business and successful in business so I can give back and help other people up. I think that's, you can call it my philanthropic mentality or altruism or whatever it is. But I feel like if I can get to this level and it allows me to have the resources, whether it's my network connections or financial resources, to really help other people later on in life, that's my goal. And I think if you continue struggling, and you continue to help people, give it away for free, you're really not helping anyone. And you're certainly not helping yourself if you don't know what your value is. And being able to say no more than you say yes, that's a very tough thing for veterans to do, because we're not geared that way. I mean, I don't know how many times you've heard it, but it continues to to plague the veteran community in the majority of people I've talked to. Now, there's a lot of exceptions to that rule, and I'm not sure who we're talking about in Shark Tank, but if it's Eli Crane, like that guy, you know, he's been crushing it with Bottle Breacher, and he's got a great business.
I mean, I suffered for a while with the same thing because, you know, it's always being in recovery, you know, being in the military, you're always doing something for others. And then, you know, but now I'm learning that you cannot pour from an empty cup. So, you know, like I'm listening to a book right now. It's called From Homeless to Billionaire. And he was talking about how he was able to take care of his mom when she was sick and give her the best medical care before she passed. So I think when we start thinking to that, you know, like you said, if we don't have anything in our cup, we can't give anything. We can't help anybody else. If we're struggling, if we're drowning, we can't help somebody else that's drowning. Mm-hmm. So I totally get that. So now talk to us about what you got going on now, what you're doing, what's the plans, what you got.
Well, I'm currently working with, I have interest in a new restaurant that's opening up in Las Vegas called Fly Pie that I was brought in. And I helped Nick Velez with the new opening of Bastards American Canteen in Temecula, California. I'm writing two books at the same time, but really the front burner item for me on a creative side is a full-length feature documentary that I'm very fortunate to be working with an executive producer, Anthony Zucker, who's created this little show called CSI that most people have heard of, and Pete Turner, who's the creator of the Break It Down Show podcast, who
I've been on that show.
Yeah,
Pete is amazing.
The documentary itself is, I can't talk about it too much because it's in pre-production right now, and we're waiting to get some more information to get it funded and start, you know, get the shooting finished. But being able to do that and introduce into filmmaking again, you know, here's a kid, me, 1.24 GPA. I wasn't a writing English major in college. I didn't study film at Columbia, but I surround myself with smart people. Because I know what I don't know. And it's also a group of people that care. Anthony cares. Gardner Cole cares. He's doing the score to my documentary. And he's done scores on Days of Thunder and Coming to America and Crossroads. And he was on Michael Jackson's production team. And he's written songs for Tina Turner. And he's an amazing dude that, you know, just this amazing talented cast of support that's helped me with this project. And so... not only that, but I'm also the executive director of SaveTheBrave.org, which is a veteran nonprofit that helps combat vets with post-traumatic stress, connect through outreach programs. I am the president of the 2-4 Association, a 501c19. And, you know, so I don't sit around eating bonbons all day. And in between those waves crashing in my inbox, you know, I try to find some time to take care of myself too. And that's an important thing too. But I love to stay busy. And I think that mindset is, you know, it's really diversification of yourself and what you've learned throughout life and being able to apply that. There's a lot of utility in being great at one thing, but I think I found a way to take the one thing I'm great at and really spread it around into a couple different mediums to continue to support and, you know, really be mutually supporting of all the endeavors that I'm involved with.
Now, you know, like one of my friends, his name is John McCaskill, and he's a retired Navy SEAL commander. And what he changed my life by him and his friend, Will Snyder, was they taught me how to learn to have a good morning routine and a good evening routine, and because this way, you know, I try to meditate and get my mind right every day. So talk to us about how you keep your cup full and what kind of routine do you have nighttime and in the mornings.
That's a good question. I think everybody's different. I like getting up early. I don't enjoy getting up early, but I get up early and I read because it's quiet. I'm unmolested by what's going on. I never turn the computer or phone on until I absolutely have to. So I try and read and become a better student of other people's stories. And I never served under Jim Mattis, but I do love his philosophy that if you haven't read 100 books in your lifetime, you're functionally illiterate. And I was a horrible reader. I didn't read my first book until I was a Lance Corporal in Desert Storm. True confession. And it was Guns Up by Johnny M. Clark. And I read in the morning. I think that's important. And then I look at my inbox, look at my messages. Anything urgent, I take care of it. If it's not urgent, I prioritize. And then I go and try and get an hour of PT in. I go to the gym. I'll go down to my barn, hit the heavy bag, do something physical. Maybe it's just yard work or it's functional fitness. But I have to do that to balance myself and to stay healthy too, because it's vital to keep your mind sharp. And then I usually go through the regular business day and make calls. And then at night is when I prefer to write. So I feel like I'm most creative at night, which is, I'm kind of a small percentage of writers that do that. I think a lot of guys write in the morning, but that's my daily routine. I think that it's pretty effective. I mean, it gets jostled around a little bit when pop-ups happen, but that's just life, you know? So
I love it. And so last question that I ask, because you already asked questions of how we can support you. So last question is, we live in a crazy world still. We're still in a COVID world. Here in New Jersey, we still have a lot of parents that lost jobs. So a lot of parents are driving Uber, DoorDash, just to put food on the table. And we have grandparents that are still homeschooling kids. So if I ask the average American to do something in 7 days, they're never going to get to it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I ask somebody to take an actionable step in the next 24 hours, they're more likely to take that step. So if there's somebody out there that's struggling, can't decide what they want to do, or if they want to start pivoting in their life, what is something they can do in the next 24 hours to start to see the light?
From a personal standpoint, you have to do that self-assessment and really ask yourself the hard questions. One is, what do I want to do? And what is the end game? I think that that's essential if on a personal level, whether it's in business or being creative, that you have to do that. Maybe it applies to your family life, but I don't think people actually write things down anymore. There's a lot of utility in that drill of physically writing things down that are important to you and then where you want to be. So that's a timeless drill. If people are really looking for a sense of purpose and mission in life, Pete Turner reminded me this last year when I rode my Harley across the country and back after my good friend Dave killed himself. And he taught me about the importance of charity and that it's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be hard. It's designed that way. It should be harder for you to give of your time that you want to spend relaxing, or give of your money that you'd rather spend on a car or a meal. That charity is something that is vital to giving yourself a sense of purpose as well and helping others. And a lot of people think they can't make a difference by just giving a donation or volunteering for something, but you can. And if everybody did that and gave a little bit to whatever organization, of course, ours is SaveTheBrave.org, but we're committed to that. Because there's so many nonprofits out there, 45,000 alone in the veteran space. We're just doing what we're great at, and that's connecting veterans in a safe space through these outreach programs, our offshore fishing program. We went from one trip in 2015 to 27 trips this year, Richard. So if you're thinking you're not making a difference or an impact, you are, and you're helping thousands of veterans and their family members reconnect and just kind of hit that reset button on life to really get them going on what they need to feel is important. So, I'm just very, very grateful to, share a little bit of my story with you and to connect with you and to anyone listening. If you need a place to find me, I'm at Echo and Ramadi on Instagram. I'm at Echo and Ramadi on Facebook. And you can give to a great veteran nonprofit at SaveTheBrave.org. And just follow us and see what we're all about at SaveTheBrave.org on Instagram. And it's an amazing organization. I'm very fortunate to be a part of it. And I tell you what, anyone out there, man, who's listening, just keep up the fire. And, you know, I'm always astounded at some of the amazing success stories that I see from our tribe as they continue to do great things.
Well, there you go, guys. Definitely pick up the book, Echo and Ramadi. Hopefully, just can't wait to see the movie that or documentary that's gonna be coming out soon. I'll be looking out for that. I guess I got to call talk to my brother Pete, say hi. It's been a while since I talked to him. Guys, definitely check out SaveTheBrave.org. And guys, if you're tired of drinking shitty coffee, definitely check out Soldier Girl Coffee, because without her, I would not be able to put this show on. Scott, thank you so much, brother, for hanging out. And as people know that when they come on my show, is the relationship just starts today. And I hope we can build on our relationship in the future. And I would love to collaborate more in the future.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much, man. Much love and Semper Fi.
Hi, brother. God bless you and have an amazing week. Hey, guys. If you're enjoying our show, if you love what we're doing, if you would like to support us, we have a whole bunch of great stuff coming out. We have a brand new t-shirt line that's coming out. Hats, coffee mugs, any kind of swag that lets your friends know that you support Vertical Momentum and you're always looking to get better. Also, we have our new coffee brand coming out. It's called Vertical Momentum Coffee. It's ass kicking coffee, and it will get you moving in the morning. So guys, if you're interested, go to www.richardkaufman.net. Check us out, leave us a note, tell us what you'd like, and we'll actually send it to you. The new website is being built. So if you guys want to, our book is out there on Amazon. It's called A Hero's Journey from Darkness to Light. Definitely check it out. It talks about my story, but it also talks about how to survive depression, how to survive addiction. All right, guys, I love you. Thank you so much for always supporting our mission, which is to save lives.
Thank you for joining us today. Please hit subscribe and share. Please feel free to leave us a comment.